Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full. Trump says that this is the greatest economy ever, but is it? There's a lot of troubling signs there. And Jamie Dimon of JP Morgan says, hey, we could be facing the great financial crisis 2.0. We're going to take a look at all of that and some more as we dive into this Finance U.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Finance U. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and today, solo, Paul is off and today, but I'm going to hold down the entire fort here. Here's what we're going to cover today. Is it the greatest economy ever? It is, depending on where you're located in that economy. If you're at the top, well, it's okay. If you're not at the top, by which I mean the top 10%, it's not that great. Actually, it's pretty bad for some people. And we're starting to see credit cracks, particularly in private credit. Will this be the catalyst that actually drives what could be GFC 2.0, Great Financial Crisis 2.0? Now, let's start right here with Trump. This is him, I believe this is on the 18th of February, somewhere back there last week. He said this.
In 50 years, a president that's won, even a popular president, somebody that's done well. I'm popular and I've done well. I mean, I think we have the greatest economy actually ever in history. We broke 50 and we broke 7,000. They said I wouldn't do that for 4 years, and I did it in 1 year. We have to get the word out, okay? If we can get the word out, we should.
Broke 50 means 50,000 on the Dow. As of today, it's under that in the 49,000 zone, and 7 means 7,000 on the S&P. So obviously, Trump is tracking the stock market as if that is a reasonable and useful broad-based barometer of how great the economy is doing. But is it? It really isn't. And then at the State of the Union, Trump just said inflation is plummeting, incomes are rising fast, the roaring economy is roaring like never before. That's not actually, well, it depends how you want to measure things, but if you measure it by GDP, which is the classic way to measure an economy, it's not really roaring at this point in time. Plus, we have to look at it in the context of a couple of things, right? Is it real growth? Is it real roaringness? Or is it fake? And as I said before, the problem is that when you reference the stock market, what you're really referencing is the top 10%. The percentage of equities here held by the wealthiest 10% of households in the United States stands at a staggering 92.5%. So when you say the stock market is doing well, you're really only talking to the top 10%. What about the bottom 90? What about the middle class, right? What about all the deciles below the 90th percentile there? It's the vast majority of households aren't represented by the stock market. Now, it's conventionally presented to us as if, like, oh, since the stock market's doing well, then everybody's doing well. So as Trump mentioned, the stock market is doing very well. I'm going to show you some reasons for why that actually is. It has less to do with how awesome things are doing and more to do with money printing. We'll get to that in a second. But let's check in now with McDonald's CEO here talking about how people are doing.
And part of what we also saw was that, particularly with middle and lower income consumers, they're feeling under a lot of pressure right now.
Said.
I think there's a lot of, you know, commentary about what's the state of the economy, how's it doing, and what we see is it's really kind of a two-tier economy. If you're upper income, earning over $100,000, things are good. Stock markets are near all-time highs. You're feeling, quite confident about things. You're seeing international travel. All those barometers of upper income consumers are doing quite well. What we see with middle and lower income consumers is actually a different story. It's that consumers under a lot of pressure. In our industry, traffic for lower income consumers is down double digits. And it's because people are either choosing to skip a meal. So we're seeing breakfast. People are actually skipping breakfast, or they're choosing to just eat at home. And so for our business, which has a significant group of consumers which are in that middle and lower income, we needed to step in with something like what we're doing here.
Well, you know, when people are finding McDonald's a little too pricey, that tells you the kind of pressure that they're under. So that kind of, these things don't really flow together, right? Greatest economy ever, roaring like it's never roared before, and people not being able to afford McDonald's. Now, maybe McDonald's has overpriced their offerings. Possible. You know, we heard in the State of the Union that incomes are rising very, very quickly, but that's an average rate, right? Maybe the incomes are rising quickly for the top 10%, but maybe not for everybody else. It's once you peel into the economic statistics, that's when you start to discover it's very easy to spin them one way or another. So I'm going to try hard not to spin them any particular way. Here's the CEO of McDonald's saying that they're noticing some drop off in middle and lower income people's ability to afford. Now, this has, as Paul and I talked about last week, this is going to have political costs, of course. You know, if you're out of touch as a president, midterms can go very badly for you. And so we're looking here at the midterm projections on Polymarket for what's going to happen in 2026, who's going to win the House. And the betting markets right now are saying Democratic Party 85%, 15% chance the Republican Party is going to win. And it's been trending down pretty steadily here for the Republicans. Well, I don't know when that, this is August, so halfway between there. Let's call that November-ish. And it's been trending up for Democrats. Now, is this roaring economy, is it real? Or isn't it real? That's the question. I look at it like this. The U.S. federal budget deficit as a percent of GDP is an important thing. They don't back it out of the GDP calculation. So if the U.S. government deficit spends 10% of GDP next year, it's 10% of GDP. And if it had, that's holding up the GDP numbers. But a lot of government spending isn't really what you and I would call particularly stimulative, economically helpful. We found out a great, great portion of it may even be just dedicated to maintaining and holding up frauds, right? Medicare frauds, healthcare frauds, NGO frauds, probably procurement frauds at the DOW now. And instead of, I almost said DOD, it's Department of War now. At any rate, so look at this. Look at this chart. In the 50s, pretty much ran a fairly balanced budget, right? And here in the 60s, a fairly balanced budget. The 70s, the bad old 70s with all their inflation, started to sneak out at almost 2% of GDP. And then, ooh, the 80s, a minus 3.8. We got it back, you know, minus 2.1, minus 2.3. Uh-oh, great financial crisis is wrapped in here. So that drags that bar down. And then, of course, we have COVID in here. But look at that number. It's astonishing. So when we say the economy is roaring, the part of it that's actually being held up by government spending is fake. It's not real. It's not the same as organic. People are really out there working hard, developing products, goods, services, enhancing productivity, getting up in the morning, doing all kinds of things. This is the government printing money. Well, the Federal Reserve prints it, but this is your government, if you're a United States citizen, borrowing money and then spending it and calling that GDP growth. And that's not really a good way to look at this. The other reason stocks do really well, of course, is because there's lots of what we call liquidity in the markets. Liquidity. What kind of liquidity? Lots of ways to measure that, but one is something called M2, which is a measure of money. There's M1, M2. There used to be M3 and MZM. The Federal Reserve did away with counting for those, particularly because I think they were telling a tale. I don't know how bad this chart, next chart would look if we had the M3 numbers, because M3 also measures all of the domestic dollars, and that's what M2 measures in the United States, but there's a lot of dollars offshore, and M3 included those, and we would love to know how many dollars are out there. Look at this astonishing chart. Starting in 2000, when global liquidity was under 30 trillion, right? Because you can see here, this is 20 to 40 trillion, so this is probably, that would be 30 by about there. Probably call that 25, 26 trillion. What is it today? 140, 144 trillion. Unbelievable. With from 2000 to 2025, a 7% CAGR, C-A-G-R, compound annual growth rate. Wow. 7%, our money supply has been expanding, 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 expanding. Now, where does all that money go? It has to go somewhere. A lot of that ends up in the markets, and that's why we see rising stock prices. That's why you see price earnings multiples expanding, where you used to be able to buy, I don't know, Exxon at a PE of 7. Now it's closer to 20. You see companies out there with PEs of 50, 60, 70, 80, 200, right? That's because all this money has to go somewhere. So when they say, look, you know, inflation is coming down, what they're really saying is the price of milk and butter, things like that, tangible things. What they're not talking about is that inflation also could include inflating prices of assets. That's also inflation because that's where the money went. Well, how do you get inflation? You get inflation wherever the money goes. So if the government prints up lots and lots and lots of money and pushes it out as stimulus checks like they did in COVID, you know what you get? You get a lot of what we call consumer inflation. Remember when they did cash for clunkers? This is a program in the United States under Obama where they paid people cash and they took their used cars, still perfectly usable things, and destroyed them, like literally crushed them, to take them off the market to kind of stimulate people buying more new cars. That was thought to be a good idea. Well, what that did was it just drove up the prices of used cars a lot, and it drove up the prices of new cars too, because we took a lot of usable capital equipment off the market and crushed it and destroyed it. So that's what happens. Point is that inflation happens, it's a monetary phenomenon, and it happens wherever the money goes. So if they print the money and give it to people, the things people buy get inflated. If they take the money and give it to Wall Street, the things Wall Street buys get inflated, right? So what would that include on Wall Street? Well, you know, stocks, bonds, trophy properties, yachts, G5, Gulfstreams, etc., things like that. All right. So that's what we're seeing here. I just wanted to point out that, you know, the Dow at 50,000 and the S&P at 7,000 may or may not be all that indicative that things are great and rosy. I know they used to indicate that, but they indicate that less so because of all of this stuff going on where deficit spending, money printing, of course, the Fed is back to printing directly. They don't call it quantitative easing. They call it reserve management balance now, but they're printing money and expanding their balance sheet again. And so all of these things create conditions where stocks go up. But again, that's favoring just 10% of the population. And every time I think Trump goes out there and it says, wow, we're all doing great. Everybody's doing great because stocks are higher. A little tone deaf given where things actually are in this story at this point in time. So with that, as soon as we come back, we're going to dive into the unbelievable data that's coming in around how poorly the consumer is actually doing at this particular point in time. And there's some pretty rough data out there, and it relates to housing, autos, credit cards, things like that. We'll be right back. Today's markets are more volatile than ever. With ongoing economic and geopolitical uncertainty, navigating such environments requires thoughtful, adaptive strategies, not a one-size-fits-all approach. At Peak Financial Investing, our registered investment advisory firm connects clients with experienced wealth managers who focus on active portfolio management. These professionals use evidence-based strategies designed to respond to changing conditions, not outdated formulas, but customized approaches grounded in research, discipline, and risk awareness. We believe in open, informed conversations, including discussing tools like precious metals and diversification as part of a broader financial strategy. Every investor's situation is unique, and our advisors tailor their guidance accordingly. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com today to schedule your free consultation and explore how proactive management can support your financial goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, proud to work with Peak Financial Investing, and my support reflects my professional views. I encourage you to take control of your financial future by making informed decisions. All right, welcome back, everybody. It's so good to be back here with you. Let's take a look now at this. You know, when a credit cycle comes to an end, that's what we're in. We're in this enormous, extraordinary credit cycle. And credit cycles are all fun and inflationary on the way up, but then they're very opposite of that on the way back down. And they're not fun. This is kind of interesting here. John Brooks on Twitter writing, first, quote, first people stop paying their credit cards, then their car loans, then their houses. U.S. car loan applications are being rejected at the highest rate in more than a decade. Credit always cracks before housing. Here's some data from the New York Federal Reserve showing that somewhere around 34% of auto loans are being rejected now, whereas that number used to be all the way down near 20% a while ago. So why are auto loans being rejected? Well, because credit conditions are tightening up. Why? Because the people who are taking out the auto loans are not a good credit risk, and the banks don't want to take on that risk. So this is a pretty important sign, but remember, it's not the destination necessarily. It's the pace that gets you there. This is a very rapid erosion in auto loan application rejection rates here. So that's one thing to keep an eye on. Two, credit card delinquencies. Because remember what John said, first thing they do is they stop paying their credit cards. Well, let's start there with this. Credit card delinquencies are now at 12.7%, rising sharply. And the last time they were this high was, in the Great Financial Crisis back here. So this is also something to watch. People obviously have a lot of credit outstanding right now. I believe the last time I saw a balance, it was around $1.2 trillion of credit card debt outstanding. So these are hundreds of billions of dollars of delinquencies right now if average balances are a thing across that universe. But it's not always the amount, but look at the direction of this. We're seeing credit card delinquencies rising. They've been rising since 2022. Off they go. What did John say? They say, well, they stopped paying their credit cards, then they stopped paying their car loans. Look at this. Subprime auto loan delinquencies. Subprime. Not all of them. All of them, I think, is down here. It's, you know, prime. Absolute prime. Very low levels of default. You can see even prime got whacked back here in the mid-90s. But subprime has not had this level of delinquency, 60-day plus delinquency rate, ever in this series. This is the highest rate on here, higher than in the mid-90s disaster, higher than the Great Financial Crisis, higher even than coming into the beginning of COVID. Of course, COVID plummeted because all the stimmy checks and the loan forgivenesses and things that happened like that and forbearances that were occurring then. But so this is something to notice here. And by the way, John Brooks also wrote about this, said, quote, the U.S. auto loan market is $1.6 to $1.7 trillion outstanding. 15 to 20% is subprime. That's roughly $250 to $300 billion. Subprime 60-plus day delinquency just hit 6.6%. Do the math. That's $17 to $20 billion of subprime loans that are already seriously delinquent. Now, who's holding that paper? Who's on the other side of this? Because you know your car dealer, when they get you involved in taking out an auto loan, they'll process a lot of that paperwork, but it isn't your auto dealer that's holding on to that paper. That goes off to another company, and that company may sell it to another company, and it'll end up somewhere. So somebody's holding on to this paper. We don't know who yet, but I'll get to that in a minute when we talk about why your insurance costs are probably going to go up. Because I think insurance companies are holding a chunk of this. Okay, then how about homes and home sales? I don't have anything on mortgage delinquencies for you here, except we have talked about commercial mortgage-backed securities before and all, you know, failing delinquency rate on that, like highest ever. But we're also seeing in the FHA loans, lots of delinquencies rising there. We presented that last time. But now we can report this week that home sales are falling through. Redfin, quoting here from Walter Bloomberg, Redfin report, nearly 1 in 7 home sales are falling through, a record for this time of year. Redfin report, nearly 40,000 home sale agreements nationwide were canceled in January. Now, I don't know why the home sales agreements were canceled. Maybe they were canceled probably on the buyer side, I would imagine, more than on the seller side, just taking a guess. Because guess what? It's a buyer's market out there right now. Gandalev here reporting, quote, U.S. housing just flipped. Sellers outnumber buyers by 600,000, the biggest gap ever recorded, from bidding wars to please take it in record time. But anyway, we're seeing lots and lots of just piled up inventory all over the place. And that's interesting because look at this. The Google trend, can't sell house, going back a decade, is this is the highest it's been. So people are starting to worry, like, I can't sell my house, can't sell house. What they really ought to be Googling is, what's the price at which my house would sell? Houses don't sell because they're priced too high. So a lot of buyers, of course, they want to hang on to those 2022 home prices that they still have stuck in their head. Maybe they don't want to take a loss. Whatever the story is, there's a lot of friction to sellers really resisting lowering price to a market clearing price. the answer to can't sell house is price too high. That's always the answer here. And so that may not be a palatable answer, but it just says that buyers have gone on strike or they've evaporated. Mortgage interest rates are actually lower. They just cracked below the six mark, 5.99. Probably still not going to move the needle because of this dynamic. They have a long way to go, these houses, before they're going to be affordable. Here's the housing problem in one chart from Nick Gehrle at ReVenture. So let's go through this together. Starts in 1965, goes through 2025. Here we're seeing median income versus income needed to buy a house. Okay, so the income needed to buy a house is in orange, and blue is the actual median household income. So this is a national average. It's going to vary a lot depending on location. Some locations have higher median incomes, but also higher house prices. But this is nationally. So we can see here that this gap between the income needed to buy a house is now stands at $109,903, and the median income is $85,405. That's a big gap. So what's that, 29,000? 15 and 9, 24,000, right? So that's a lot. That's a huge thing. So what happens? Well, what happens is, and look, this was even worse than the housing bubble, right? The housing bubble had this gap right here. And then we had the 80s, that bad old 80s. We had this long sustained period here. But sometimes, believe it or not, houses are actually below the price, the median income. From time, this is a fair market. This is a kind of a fairly balanced market here from 1965 to 1975. This is actually a market which is a great time to buy houses, right? Maybe a lot of boomers bought houses back then. This is another okay time to buy houses during this period of time. This is not. And this all starts right here in 2020. Stimmy checks, pump the markets, Federal Reserve printing, all of the rest. And so that drove this extraordinary housing bubble, which has now created a situation where we have young people, young families starting out saying they just can't afford. They just can't afford to get a house. In many places, it's actually cheaper to rent than to own. And remember, none of us really owns a house, right? When you own a house, you're responsible for all the maintenance. You got to keep it operating, and you have to pay property taxes. You have to your local government. And if you don't do that, they'll take it from you, which means you're not really an owner, to be honest. You're just a renter under a different set of circumstances at that point in time. So this chart is amazing. This is why I think we have that so-called buyer's strike. And when they start, when they actually start, when these things finally tip over, when the housing bubble, and that's a housing bubble, that's what that orange line represents here. That is a housing bubble. When those bubbles finally burst, they're a slow thing. You know, first what happens is inventory starts to pile up a little bit and a little bit more. And then you hit some magic mark, and then all of a sudden house prices start to come down a little. And that'll stimulate some buying, but even more people who were going to be buyers just sit back and go, whoa, prices are coming down. I'll just wait it out, particularly if I can wait it out with a rental fee that's cheaper than a mortgage with the principal, insurance, taxes, all that stuff wrapped in there. So this is the housing bubble and the housing problem in just one chart. Real estate is not one thing. It's a lot of different things. There's a class of real estate, which is mobile homes, rental storage units, multifamily, mid-bay, industrial, and what else? Commercial office real estate is the commercial mortgage-backed security market, the CMBS market. Woo! Some real troubles. Chicago, triple net investor rating here, Chicago office buildings continue to get massacred. A landmark Chicago Loop office building, looks like a nice building, nice picture, recently took a 90% haircut. The 1.4 million square foot building sold for 41 million, or just 29 bucks a square foot. Last sold for 306 million in 2018. So this is a tale of several things. It was COVID. It was the beginning of the diaspora workforce who no longer had to go to work, remote working, things like that, losing connection with the idea that you have to get out of bed early and fight traffic and struggle and park and walk and come into an office. That's not really coming back. And so what do you do with a big building like that? You might think, well, I could repurpose it, but that's harder than it actually looks and sounds. Repurpose it to what? To housing? all the layouts are all wrong, where the pipe chases are, where the plumbing is or isn't, all wrong. A lot of work to get those into some other use. They were built as office buildings. It's kind of what they are. So they don't have as much use in that anymore. And of course, if you're in Chicago, you're just getting absolutely abused with property taxes. And the more they abuse people with property taxes, the more they make buildings like this less favorable. And it's a cycle. It's a whole cycle where it goes. All right. So those are just a few of the things that we're seeing here beneath the surface. And of course, labor is weak right now. Lots of things are kind of weak. So Trump's saying this is the greatest economy ever. I don't know. He's clearly not availing himself of all the statistics that apply to, I would say, the broad swaths of people out there. Like this. So without knowing these things, I think from his perspective, things could look great, could be rosy, but really they're not at this point in time. So what does that mean for our markets? Let's talk about this real quick. I'm going to just go down to here. Yeah. So what we've talked about for a while here, last week, week before with Paul of Kiker Wealth Management, what we talked about was this idea that there's a little bit of a rotation going on in the stock markets right now. There's a little bit of a situation where we're seeing retail is buying, but big money institutions are selling, and that trend still continues. It causes me a little bit of concern for the average investor out there. I hope they know what they're doing. But if we look here, this is for the last week. This takes us between February 16th and February 20th. And we also have the four-week average. So last week, we see that institutional and hedge funds all sold out bigly. Like they were just, they're out big time. Over the last four-week average, we can see that retail's actually been buying over the last 4 weeks. Institutional money is out. Hedge funds pretty flat. And the total comes to this number. But it's really so institutional selling, retail buying. That's the story over the last month. This is often called the smart money because they know what they're looking at. And this is sometimes called the dumb money or the bag holders in this story. It's not my term. That's a Wall Street term. It's a term of endearment. So how you know they love you. That's what they call us. So looking at this, I'm a little worried about that, particularly since we're starting to see warning signs that we might be coming into something that has a lot of similarities with the great financial crisis. So let's talk about this. Are we going to see the great financial crisis 2.0? Is that what we're facing? Well, we're going to talk about that just as soon as we come back. Markets are facing heightened uncertainty, and thoughtful portfolio management has never been more important. If your current strategy relies solely on passive investing or diversification without active oversight, it may be time to consider a different approach. At Peak Financial Investing, we connect you with experienced wealth managers who actively manage portfolios using disciplined, research-driven strategies designed to adapt to evolving market conditions. Our focus is on helping clients navigate volatility with clarity and confidence. While no investment strategy can guarantee results or eliminate risk, we believe that preparation and active management can make a meaningful difference over time. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com to schedule a complimentary consultation and explore whether our approach aligns with your goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, and I am proud to support Peak Financial Investing. This is not a guarantee of future performance, but a call to take your financial planning seriously. Again, that's peakfinancialinvesting.com. Investing, of course, involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Please consult with a qualified advisor before making investment decisions. All right, welcome back, everybody. Hey, let's start here. Let's go to the Great Financial Crisis 2.0. Chris, that seems a little bearish, a little contrarian, hyperbole, you know? Well, that's actually a quote from Jamie Dimon, of the CEO of JP Morgan. And Jamie Dimon, he says here, quote, asked about fierce competition across the financial industry, said he's starting to see parallels to the era before the 2008 financial crisis when a rush to make loans ended disastrously. And so this is from an article by Hannah Levitt in Bloomberg on February 23rd, 2026. Carrying on, he says here, quote, "Unfortunately, we did see this in 05, 06, and 07, almost the same thing. The rising tide was lifting all boats. Everyone was making a lot of money." And, you know, he said here, "I see a couple of people doing some dumb things. They're just doing dumb things to create net investment income or interest income." That would be net interest income, NII, he called. Anyway, so what are they doing? So what's the dynamic? The dynamic is this. As the Fed throws all this money into the markets and the federal government's busy trying to stimulate everything to create the greatest economy ever or whatever, and stocks are going up and they're getting inflated and bubbly, what happens is there's so much competition for anything that looks like it's generating income that people start to reach a little bit, right? The bankers get a little aggressive. They maybe don't do quite the due diligence they did before. They're willing to sweep aside some things. They're going to drop covenants on the loans. They're going to do all kinds of things in an attempt to outbid the next guy or gal, right? Because they want to get the business. And so they start really doing some very creative things, and they start pouring money into some dumb things. And that brings us to possibly the epicenter. Last time, it was derivative paper around houses, okay? We had collateralized debt obligation, CDOs, and we had CLOs, collateralized loan obligations. That was sort of the fancy pants stuff they were doing then. Those are still operating, by the way, but nothing changed. We still have those. But they started to figure out another angle on this whole thing, of course, because Wall Street's clever. It's very creative. History doesn't always rhyme. You know, it doesn't always exactly repeat, but it does rhyme. It's rhyming again. And this time we have to look at something called private credit. Private credit is this thing where loans are made in a somewhat private way and, you know, not using banks and coming through other avenues, and money is loaned and all of that. So this is from November 17th, last year, 2025. We're going to start there because we have to say how to start, right? So 2025 was a big year for private credit being pushed out of the Wall Street funds as fast as they could into, well, unfortunately, into 401ks and insurance companies, things like that. We'll get to that in a second. So here's how it started. Headline: How Private Equity Got Its Hands on Billions in Americans' Retirement Money. Today on The Big Take, Apollo, the big giant firm, hedge firm, money firm, Apollo reinvented how Wall Street handles pensions. Retirees and regulators are worried about the risks. Oh, that's how it started. Here's how it's going. Here's some of those private credit funds. And, ooh, ouch. We see here that OWL, Ares, APO are down anywhere from 20 to nearly 30% this year. Okay, this is year to date. So they are hemorrhaging pretty badly at this point in time. And those are actual mega losses. How big? Pretty big. Here we see Junk Bond Investor writing just yesterday saying German dentists put 2.2 billion euros of retirement savings into private credit. Unlisted companies, real estate, half of it is gone. Investments included a California plastic recycler, a German shrimp farm, WTF, and a Berlin insurance startup. Dentists, every time. So a lot of this private credit was concocted on Wall Street. They extracted their fees. They did what they wanted to get out of it, and then they dumped it off into pensions. They do it every time. Happens over and over again. This is interesting. So we look at here at this is from June of 2025, so barely, not even a year ago, because this is now still February 2026. In Moody's, they said, well, life insurers stay bullish on private credit. Quote, approximately one-third of the sector's $6 trillion in cash and invested assets was allocated to private credit instruments as of the end of 2024. There was a big push to get more of this stuff out of Wall Street's hands into insurance portfolios in 2025. So I don't know what the number is as of today. I'm going to guess it's higher. So that's $2 trillion is allocated into private credit investments. And to give you a sense of like how these things can go bad and how quickly they can go bad, let's rewind ourselves all the way to 2023. So long ago. I know. I'll get there in just one second. So, yeah. Forgot this slide was here. Apollo's latest $10 billion wizardry to woo insurer cash. Apollo's busy out there trying to you just, hey, we got this great stuff for you. You're going to make so much money on this. We're, you know, we would hold it ourselves, but we really like you. Is that the sales pitch, right? Something like that. So let's rewind and talk about this, you know, and right now they're starting to wonder, hey, is private equity about to have a we crash moment? Meaning, if you remember this company called WeWork, well, I'll tell you a little bit about it in just a second, but it was an idea. It was an idea of how to be clever in the real estate space, create these little work environments for people, and just the whole thing just blew up, right? Here's how it blew up. This is instructive, how things go bad. Let's talk about how things go bad really quick. So here in August of 2023, we see that WeWork bonds were yielding almost 90%. That's a pretty good yield, which it means is they're probably not going to pay you anything, right? You won't. The bonds are going to become worthless before you have a chance to collect any dividends off of them at all. But this was fascinating. WeWork actually was the most obviously destroyed business out of COVID, because it was this whole idea that people are going to go to offices and you're going to rent out office space. So their model was they would lease a building at for X, and then they would cut it up into little things and usually have to put some rehab money into that to get it set up right and everything and get it chunked out. But then they would rent it out in little units at X plus Y, and that's the model. Makes sense. Got destroyed by COVID. So I watched these bonds spike through into here. Surprisingly, we come into COVID itself, and I thought for sure these things tank immediately. They didn't. They kept getting, you know, coming into the COVID thing, and they actually got bought all the way back down to close to par. They were 7 7/8 at issue. Here you can see they're basically at par here, right here, 2021. I'm like watching this the whole time going, how can this be? Their whole business model is completely destroyed, and I don't get it. I still don't get it. Maybe this is one of those Big Short moments where, you know, driving the price of the bonds higher and higher, which is what's happening here as we watch the yield fall, then maybe that made sense in somebody's balance sheet on Wall Street because they had some other fancy derivatives layered on top of that, credit default swaps and stuff. I don't know. Not my game. But at any rate, I was surprised to see it fall. But then, of course, it came and spiked and did a little, I don't know, EKG heart attack moment there. And then, bing, off. That's August of 2023. Didn't have to wait long because in November of 2023, WeWork filed for bankruptcy. And if you want to know how this works, George Poo's telling us here, that's February 24 this year, said WeWork raised $22 billion, IPO'd at $9, went bankrupt at 4 cents, but Adam Neumann, that gentleman there, Adam Neumann walked away worth $1.7 billion, and employees who took stock instead of salary, and some did, got zero. Welcome to Wall Street, everybody. That's how it works. They walk off with billions, and everybody else is left holding the bag. So that's what I'm a little bit worried is happening right now. We're watching the stock market very mysteriously be held up at this point in time. It's hanging on, and it's kind of mysterious how it hangs on, and the president's talking it up. And meanwhile, what we're seeing on a pretty routine basis now is that institutions are quietly offloading their stocks and retail is snapping them up. And so that's equivalent to this moment right here. Whoever was buying these bonds from here to here got absolutely slaughtered on this trade. So I don't know how that happened or why that happened or how they created the condition for that. Didn't make a bit of sense to me then. Doesn't make any sense to me now. Same as watching what's happening in the overall market. So with that summary, very, very, very clear what's happening here. It's a K-shaped economy for sure. Tale of two worlds, right? Yes, I get it. There's a lot of investment income going into things like data centers, and that creates jobs and does things like that. But we have this whole AI tsunami coming, which is just about to displace and disrupt and pick any other D word you want, our entire economy. And I don't think anybody's really appreciating just how fast that's coming or what that means in terms of jobs, the economy, work, or even what money really means in that environment. And so for that, all those reasons, I think it's vitally important that you have a risk-managed approach to how you all your investments are handled at this point in time. An absolutely vital thing is to be sure that you are really being nimble in this environment and paying very, very close attention, because it's not the headline. That's what, you know, we have busy lives and we see the headline. You have to look under that to see what's actually happening down there. And there's some concerning signs. Are they flashing double bright red siren warning lights? Not yet. But private credit is starting to send off some severe rumblings. And the reason I wanted to bring up the WeWork story was kind of like, slowly, then all at once. Everything's kind of fine. You hear some rumblings. Jamie Dimon comes out and goes, a little worried. Some parallels here to 08, you know? And the next thing you know, that actually does like really hit, and hit hard and fast. That's the suddenly part of the story. So that's the thing with credit. You know, how did Hemingway go broke? Slowly, then all at once. How do credit markets tend to crack? Slowly, then all at once. We're seeing those first cracks. We see it in consumer credit. We're seeing it in corporate credit. We're seeing it in private credit. The cracks are there. Again, this could all sort itself out, but maybe not. So with that, thanks very much for listening. And please be sure to go to peakfinancialinvesting.com if you want to talk with somebody like Paul Kiker's amazing team at Kiker Wealth Management to assess your portfolio, find out if you are positioned for all of this, and if not, what you might be able to do about that to manage the risk as best you can. We're in one of those environments where managing risk is really important. Paul and his team do a great job at that. Very, very good. And plus, they're very good at working with people, and it's the people skills that matter in this story too. So with that, thanks very much for listening. Again, go to peakfinancialinvesting.com, fill out a simple form, and somebody from Paul's team will get back to you if you would like to engage in that conversation. Until next time, be safe, everyone. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you next week. Bye for now.